schools, but also lower secondary school, where we collaborate with teachers to develop pedagogy, understood not as like a, not narrowly as a teaching method, but rather as a more broad way how the teachers, how the students, how the other personnel in schools organize themselves to create learning experiences for students, but also for themselves, for adults. I'm interested in kind of intergenerational learning processes between students and multiple adults in their lives in relation to the ongoing severe climate crisis that humanity is facing. And I consider that climate crisis partly as a learning process, learning of humanity, learning of societies, learning of communities, learning of individuals. So it requires learning at these multiple levels. And it requires also quite different learning that schools in the recent decades in Finland and in most countries abroad are used to. I think schools are mostly about learning skills to work effectively in society. But we really need to kind of master the future. We really need to reorganize the society in major ways. We need activism, I would argue. We need, I'm sorry, I have a mistake in the title, never mind. two times duplicate them. So for these reasons, the subtitle of my talk is Promoting Youth Climate Activism in Formal Education. And the notion of utopia is important in this respect, because we need to make bold initiatives. We need to propose alternatives that are somehow radically different from the present way of living and organizing activity in municipalities, in societies. I start with the idea of utopia and why it's needed in this contemporary ages. Where does it come from? And from there, I proceed to discuss some methodological ideas for research in education, designing learning environments, designing pedagogy. And in the third part of my talk, I will give examples from the work we are doing in those innovative schools. The word utopia, I think the idea of utopia can be found in many cultures, and it's not only a Western idea. But the word itself is an artificial word coined by the author Thomas More in his fictional novel, which was titled Utopia, and it was situated in a faraway imagined island where things would be better than in the current time society of his time in the 16th century. And utopia, the word, is kind of a wordplay between Greek words eutopos, which means a good place, and utopos, which means no place or nowhere. So there is this irrevocable tension in the concept of utopia, that it's inherently something better, but it's at the same time impossible. And my colleague Keijo Lakkala, who is in our research group, who is a philosopher, has done excellent PhD dissertation on the history of the notion of utopia in European culture. And he claims that in Moore's age before the time of enlightenment, utopias used to be situated in faraway spaces, islands, and later like in space and so forth. However, later, through the Enlightenment and through the kind of conquest of the whole world by Europeans and all those like expeditions, the geographical space became kind of more or less known, and utopia started to be situated in future. So there began the idea that the future would be better than the present day, and enlightenment and modernity could be envisaged as utopian projects in this sense. So here are a couple of other examples of situating utopia in somewhere else geographically, like the Garden of Eden in the Christian religion, or the famous novel A Modern Utopia by Wells. However, this idea, modern idea of like better future, it became into disrepute after the Second World War, and people lost their faith in these great narratives and ideas that we would kind of come together around a single utopian future with the fall of the Soviet Union, with the fall of Nazism. But I, at the same time, I would say that capitalism, considered like experiments in Chile and other experiments which kind of wanted to implement capitalism in its purest forms, it's also based on beliefs and ideas of about the future and about better world and about human. So many things that are not inherently considered as utopian are actually utopian. And with the collapse of the Berlin Wall in the 1980s, in the end of 1980s, there became this idea that history has ended, that the liberal democracy has won, and we, as humanity, would have already kind of arrived in a sort of utopia. I think it's very important, although utopia concept is often associated with kind of left-wing utopias, mainly socialism, through many writers in sociology. I think it's conceptually important to detach utopia from any specific content, such as socialism. The Ruth Levitas, British sociologist, whom I work use in my work, who is a socialist herself, is making this argument, because in that case, it becomes possible to question ideas that utopia is dead. We don't have any utopias any longer. However, we can expose utopian thinking in very commonplace ideas, which kind of are naturalized as pragmatic or common sense. And more recently, we have this, what some people call the crisis era. I think most notably the climate emergency. Let me see if I have, I don't have the pictures here, but also it can be considered to start from the financial crisis of 2008. And then we have had multiple political crises and a health crisis and so forth. So it seems that the discussion about the end of history has, by Francis Fukuyama, who was the author from, I think he's from University of Stanford, who wrote this famous book about end of history. We have started to question these notions in the global north again, and considering that in fact probably we need alternatives. and radical alternatives. And I would like to make a comment also on the Nazism and also kind of Soviet Union. I think those historical developments contributed to the idea that utopia is not only unrealistic, which is often used pejorative idea, but it's also dangerous, that it revolves around a single idea, and if you disagree, you are silenced or maybe even put to a prison camp or put to death. So there were many decades that people in the global north were not so enthusiastic about utopia. However, in my talk, I will discuss how we can and we should reconceptualize utopia, because those ideas rely on the modern understanding of future, that of utopia, that we are heading towards better future and have this kind of single idea of better world. But I will get to this soon. And I have been now discussing the idea of global north, and this is a conference on global education, global ideas. Although the concept of utopia comes from the European heritage, I think that it's very important idea in every culture. And I think this climate movement, especially the youth, has been very global in this understanding. And if you think about like countries in the global north, whose utopias get space, whose utopias are amplified in the public discussion, it has been mainly European males. But these ideas are partly also related to the modern ideas of utopia and have been recently and not only so recently questioned, like with feminist utopias, and also some people such as decolonialist Boaventura Sousa Santos is making the argument that actually European critical theory has exhausted itself and new ideas are not actually coming from global north, but from other parts of the world. And here I would like to point this like youth climate activist movement, because I think that's really an authentic global movement, because the climate crisis itself is a global crisis. It's affecting people disproportionately differently in different parts of the world. But also noteworthy with the youth climate movement is as it's utopian in the sense of striving towards better worlds. It's utopian, but it's also led by youth, young people, even school age children. And probably this is the first time in the world history that so young people have become like historical agents at the world stage. So with these ideas in mind, I'd like to offer a rationale for studying this as an educational idea. So how this crisis era, and in particular the climate crisis, the ecological crisis, how it really positions the youth in a different manner with agency. I use the notion of agency, which is willingness and capability to act upon your circumstances and not just like reproduce, but change things. So it positions youth in a very interesting ways in relation to the curriculum and in relation to the world and in relation to adults. So although all learning is intergenerational, I think learning about climate crisis, learning to act upon climate crisis is intergenerational in a specific way. That becomes theoretically interesting for research. Okay, I mentioned Ruth Levitas, who is a British sociologist. she has done terrific work in reconceptualizing utopia, researching its history in the tradition of sociology, and she proposes this new definition of utopia, that it's the core of utopia is the desire for being otherwise, individually and collectively, subjectively and objectively. Its expressions explore and bring to debate the potential contents and contexts of human flourishing. It is thus better understood as a method than a goal. I would like to point a few points in this very, very interesting definition. First of all, utopias are not only like cognitive in the sense that we would like visualize it. It very importantly involves the idea of emotion, like desire and hope. And another point I want to highlight here is the idea of exploration. So rather than positing the better world and imposing it on others, this notion of utopia is much more tentative. It's about exploring and debating in democratic dialogue. So it addresses the critique of utopia being dangerous. And it also brings to question the idea of human flourishing, and rather have a single idea of human flourishing, such as involved, for example, in the happiness indexes that are being used. It brings the idea of human flourishing to debate. What do we mean like good life? What do we mean by good society? What do we mean by good world? And finally, it's in the title of her book, Utopia as a Method. So essentially, utopia is something that we all the time discuss, rather than positing as a single goal, have like plural goals and have this kind of debate. And like I said, in terms of content, not associating it with a single idea, for example, socialism, but rather exposing utopian goals also in the pretty mainstream ideas as like meritocracy or the idea of growth and the reduction of debt as a goal, or that we need like full employability. Although from some perspectives those are all good ideas, but on other perspectives they are questionable. So we should expose those ideas as alternatives and rather not naturalized. And bring those in debate. And in some of our research with high schools in Finland, we have found out that the teachers tell us that in Finland, education is not so much about like alternatives or future. It's rather about how the world is or how the world has been in the past, not how it could be or should be or so forth. And so regarding the pedagogical potential of the notion of utopia, I argue that there would be a lot of scope for transforming education in this crisis period to this kind of ideas. And maybe education in the global north has been shaped by the idea of enlightenment, with the idea that we are heading towards a clear, better future, rather than like continuous discussion in the globalized world between different worldviews and between different thought traditions and between adults and youth about ideas of better life. And I started with the notion by referring to my colleague Keijo Lakkala's work. He said that utopias were first situated in islands and faraway places, then in the future. But in the crisis era that we are currently living in Europe and North America, and I think the whole world, is that the utopia becomes much more tentative, aligning with Levita's work, as he calls it counterlogical practice. As not as like a clear alternative that that everyone on the whole world should do, but rather as experimenting with different ways of doing. And it's just a recap of Levita's notion of utopia, which forms the one of the foundations of my own work and with colleagues. Utopia is reflexive, it's provisional, it's dialogical, and it's not a blueprint, or it might be a blueprint. It involves goals, but like in a plural form that you have multiple ideas which are debated. And I have done a book review of this in the journal Mind, Culture and Activity. You can have a look at it as well, but I recommend you look at the book of Levitas. Another important theorist of utopia is the sociologist Eric Ulin-Bright, who passed away recently, unfortunately, and also I used the notion of concrete utopias from Eros Bloch. So utopias should be associated with varied contents, but also with varied forms. So it's not only a novel or film, but it can also be a practice. It can be ways of doing things. And with these ideas, concrete utopias are contrasted with abstract utopias, which express desire, which are not grounded in the real change possibilities of the world. Like the, you can consider like the travel to moon. It was first abstract utopia for many centuries, and gradually it was transformed into hope in the idea that it would actually be realized. And with the technology coming, it became a concrete utopia and then a reality that we are doing. So there is this dialectic between abstract and concrete utopias. So concrete utopias, according to Eros Bloch, the German philosopher, leverage actual potential for change in the existing activity, and it's related with hope. And my focus is also not on these grand utopias of modernity, but rather more modest utopias, which are contrasted to comprehensive visions for reconstituting society. So what would be the role of utopia in schools? So Wright talked about institutional innovations in educational, well, he didn't talk so much about educational settings, but I'm talking about educational settings. So there are institutional innovations which are crucial in preparing societies for more comprehensive and far-reaching transformations. And he used the notion of real utopias, which are considered as way stations, so that these new innovations are implemented in a small scale, in a varied forms, and together they help to move towards like a more far-reaching changes in societies. And he gave some examples of participatory city planning from Porto Alegre, Brazil, then Wikipedia, universal basic income. All these, like, for example, Wikipedia, it's a dictionary, but its meaning is not a dictionary, but it gets its meaning from the utopian vision of free exchange of knowledge. And by its very existence, it's providing existence proof that these are not like unrealistic ideas, but actually these are something that, although seemingly impossible, they can be implemented and made to work. But the notion with Levitas that these are provisional, we should treat them as provisional and examine their viability, examine their achievability, and be prepared to admit that some of it doesn't work. I'm using cultural historical activity theory in my research, and utopia has been taken up not only by me and my colleagues, but also some other researchers like Annalisa Sannino from University of Tampere, who is studying the Housing First project in Finland, in which there is a relatively radical idea that homelessness is best treated by giving people an apartment. And it's world famous, having get very good results, but not perfect. And Chris Gutierrez from University of Berkeley, with whom I'm also collaborating, they had this Migrant Student Leadership Institute near University of California, Los Angeles, where they brought like youth and children of farmers with Mexican origin and other immigrants who were very poor in the area, to a summer camp to prepare them for the university, and challenging these like beliefs about these young students, and that they would not be worth studying in the university, but rather having a utopian vision that these young students would also have a strong potential to excel, and they had these summer camps, and one crucial insight here was to show the diverse forms and the variety of the idea of utopia. That just one example was when these students coming to the campus were kind of used to racist taunts. They were like, told that you don't belong here in the campus, and they used a lot of drama and this kind of embodied activities, and they like said that now we are walking from here to there with our straight backs and just like proud of ourselves. So kind of this embodied gesture of having us back straight rather than looking to the ground could be considered as a, like a utopia moment. We have recently wrote a paper which will be published very soon in the next few weeks about utopia methodology as using utopia as a research methodology in design-based research. And this is forming the basis of my work. So then the focus is on culturally organized activities in their institutional settings and wider socio-historical culture context as units of analysis. Utopian designs are studied in the process of their enactment and formation. We use this cultural historical activity theory for that, to not only study examples of utopia, but also how they came about and how they evolve. And the focus here is on the life course of activities embodying the utopian designs. We study the development of these activities at varying levels of inclusive and mutual interchange at the intersecting time scales. So we try to study them when they start and how they evolve. And even we give examples of following utopian innovations across decades, and also studying when they die, because eventually all these are going to kind of turn down as things change. And by studying also how they lose their energy and how those resources become reallocated to other activities, we can understand the contexts which are the educational contexts which are like supporting or inhibiting these utopias. And we use the metaphor of the firefly. There is a lot of critical research on education reforms. One foremost names here are the educational historians Tyke and Cuban, who said that educational reforms may look successful when judged soon after adoption, but in fact, they may turn out to be fireflies flickering brightly but soon fading. So they were quite pessimistic about any kind of radical change in education. So we take the notion of firefly as a metaphor, but have a more optimistic content for that. So how could we create conditions for and sustaining the potential radical content of the utopian design? First, you create a firefly, then you seek to create the firefly that casts its light for as long as it's properly fed and cared for, so that those educational designs which we as researchers implement together with the practitioners, they would persist even after we leave. And that's quite a tall order. It's a difficult goal, because utopian designs also tend to be assimilated to their environments, and we use the notion of domestication. I hope to give a couple of examples soon. So in the paper, we analyze utopia in different stages in goal formation, and then implementing a utopian design in a new country, in a new context, and also sustainability over the long haul, like over decades. If there is seldom a possibility to organize such and fund such research projects. But as a utopian researcher, I have been inspired by these ideas, so that I want to follow the work of these teachers and work with them and see how these activities are developing, so that we don't implement just like one project or one course which is ending, but rather trying to provide some sustainability. And you can see some of the research questions we used in the paper. So to recap the utopian methodology, it's a kind of a meta term that you could like use many different kinds of design-based research, such as the Change Laboratory or others. But you attend to these general principles. So you create conditions for sustaining and regenerating the utopian goal explicitly, and to guard against it becoming domesticated. For example, we discuss actually equity and racism in this paper. So we discuss the case when racism is raised for discussion in a kindergarten context, but eventually you don't talk about like addressing the racism in the staff and in the neighborhood, but rather you start to talk about equity in terms of like children being nice to each other, and it's very hard to challenge the status quo and challenge the power relations. But how in utopia method you explicitly tackle that goal and try to keep that alive, and then you examine the recurring challenges to viability and achievability of utopian design in its learning ecology that emerge for observation over multiple time scales. So this is kind of an orientation to understand utopian designs and how they live in environments over time, and each of the time scales, like looking at them moment to moment, how they are enacted, how they start, and over like years and over decades, you with all these different timescales, you get like different insight. And the final one, the self-critique and collaborative redesign for a new iteration, the Levitas idea that utopia should be provisional rather than like given blueprints, that you also be relatively transparent and open about the problems of your design and why it failed, and assuming that it will ultimately fail, and then studying why it failed, and that gives us important information about the ideas and about the contexts, like educational settings in which we try to implement them. We are fairly generous in our self-criticism in that paper. Okay, so moving to a couple of concrete examples. If I think I couldn't start at 7, at 2, so if it's possible, I can talk still like 10 minutes. In this project, we pose four objectives. Examine the pedagogical potential of the concept of concrete utopia to support diverse youth in envisioning alternative futures and enacting them in the present. And developing pedagogical model for fostering youth agency and climate activism based on the concept of concrete utopias. Examine the feasibility and achievability of this model in formal education settings. So they are kind of concrete and real, these utopias. They are not just like ideas, but we actually, with the youth, we try to put them into practice and examine whether they work and why. And we try to, as researchers, we try to generate empirical research knowledge about students' learning and agency development through their engagement in envisioning and building concrete utopias, and advance empirically grounded understanding of the ethical and political dimensions of learning, agency, and pedagogy. So when you challenge the naturalized ideas of utopia and bring them to debate, it's considered political often, and then there are kind of limits for the teachers what they can can do, because they are expected to enforce the kind of given ideas about world, about society, about life, about humanity. I argue that learning, teaching is inherently political. That's kind of a truism, and at this stage, it's our political mission to discuss those alternatives. But it introduces tensions in the field. Teachers might feel uncomfortable. So I think it becomes important to also research those empirically, those what are those tensions, what is possible, and study in different places, like we study in rural areas and in the metropolitan areas. Okay, let's first look at this pedagogical potential with a couple of examples. I skip this. I just show that we have we're working with several schools in south of Finland, in collaborative partnerships with the teachers and the youth, and we also involve some youth activists and NGOs in our research. But here are a couple of examples. In Otaniemi Upper Secondary School, they have experimented with alternative forms of food production. These are like what these utopias look like in practice. And they have the teachers there have been creating this what they call food learning environment. It's situated near the University of Technology, though, so they have opportunities to collaborate with community, what I call community partners, these like researchers. And I'm arguing that this utopian pedagogy involves community partners. It extends beyond the school. And it's kind of a learning process which involves multiple adults and youth. So they have this, you can see the upper left picture, and there in the lower right corner of the first picture, you can see those ilmaperunat, air potatoes, which are forms of potatoes that don't need soil. They can kind of grow in thin air. So kind of these alternatives forms of food. And they have created biocarbon by collecting sticks from around the school. And they also created these bokashi composts. And the teachers have been quite innovative in putting together different courses. It's not so easy to implement this in the constraints of time of upper secondary school. You have the curriculum and you have the matriculation exams and so forth. So they have put like different courses, and they have like attempted this like all the time for several years. And you can see also pictures of the balcony where they grew some vegetables with the biocarbon, with things that they had used in kind of their composts. Those bokashi composts are such that you can compost your food in like a normal building, and they had used some leftover food. So these students from these different courses all contributed to this like balcony where they grew the food, and the student voluntary climate activism group, they organized a cafeteria and vegan cafeteria in the school, and donated the funds to Afghanistan at that time. So it's a collaborative effort, and the students who during their biology course studied about biocarbon could kind of contribute to this bigger utopian effort, and the students found it very meaningful in a way. So it created a context in which this kind of educational activities of the high school were linked to this more like utopian pursuits, pursued over many years by the teachers. So they are continuing this still. And then Bicycles on the Move project, the second one, this was organized in Espoo as well, in Otaniemi Upper Secondary School. And here the idea was that the students, together with their teachers, they examined the kind of conditions for cycling in the neighborhood. They took pictures of their surroundings, and then they discussed those in classroom. They collaborated with cycling activists, with city planners, and with researchers. So again, you can see this pedagogy bringing together different community partners, different adults with new ideas, and the students contributing to it. And they actually managed to, they also tried to change those conditions. In 2010, it was still quite new, and they were scolded by some of the city planners, even considered like manipulating the students. So you can here see how these utopian projects are challenging the status quo and what is considered achievable or non-achievable or impossible now might be achievable in 10 years. And now we are writing retrospective analysis of this project happening like 10 years ago with the teachers. The nowadays that orientation to cycling has been completely changed just in 10 years. So this shows the importance of the utopian work. What would be impossible now might not be impossible in 10 years. And some of the things they achieved was they wrote a complaint to the city council around the traffic solutions of one of the big train stations there. And they filed this complaint together with the cycling activist group, and they won. They could actually influence the travel arrangements around a major train station. So you can see here the idea of putting these, enacting these ideas, putting these utopian ideas in practice in the small scale. And finally, climate warriors. It's a climate aid activism group in Lempäälä Upper Secondary School, more in a rural area. It started around 5 years ago when you had these climate strikes by youth, and they were a lot in the media. Some of the students were anxious and had anguish about the climate crisis, and the teacher was organizing at that time entrepreneur education, and he put this together because it arose from this youth interest, and they started with this idea of climate warriors, organizing first this exhibition with second-hand clothes, and it was a huge success. So with this like 10 students, they started to do this, and then more students joined, it's kind of a course. The students get credit for that, but they are like free to participate when they can, and there are currently almost 100 students and many teachers in this climate warriors, and they are doing all sorts of climate actions at the different levels. For example, they are just picking garbage around the community, but they have also influenced the school vegetarian service, so that every student will get vegetarian food if they want, just it's available. You don't have to have a special permission for that. You don't have to get that from different place, and it's even served first. So without making a big fuss of it, every student in the school have started to eat more vegetarian food. And they also applied funding to create arboretum in the area, tree arboretum, and they are collaborating with the city planners to implement that. So again, you can see this like community partners, so city planners to create the and also the funding source they applied for from foundation this money. And they are also doing social media campaigns. They are participating at national events. So they are doing all sorts of things at different levels. And all of this is coordinated through some of like meetings there in the school. The teacher's role is actually super important here. When you bring this climate activism in schools, I think even though it's student-centered, the students consider the teacher's very important role of organizing it, because they probably don't have time in addition to their studies, and also they have used WhatsApp and this like communication tools very effectively to coordinate something that's like more than 80 people. And they are also dividing their work so that not everyone is doing the same thing, but some people are even just cooking for them. It's very communal process, so the food has very important meaning. And some people don't have much time; they just participate by baking or cooking for the events. And when I talk with these students, they feel that they are part of the movement, and there are a lot of informal discussions among the students about climate change. And some people are meeting, like, you know, Minister of Education or something like that. So you have varied different roles. Some people are drawing things, doing posters, or managing the social media accounts. I've noticed that I'm coming quite to the end. I don't have time now to explain all of these things, but we have published something, and you can soon find our website where we share these papers. So maybe I would like to say a few things about this achievability and sustainability of this utopian design with these climate warriors. Like I said, in this utopian methodology, we attend to the long haul. So rather than a single project, we try to see how these things root in the school culture, and this climate warriors activity has persisted over 5 years. The students have changed, and it kind of the activity continues, and how you create foundations for this. And in the beginning, it was a little bit like some of the students were teased for being that, but over time it has become really mainstream, and it's become kind of cool in the school to be part of this. So when you do this over a long time, it gets rooted, that people, these activities get known, and it has become for the school as kind of a selling point to get students. But maybe I will finish here so that we have a chance to discuss a little bit with you. If you have any questions and thoughts, I would be happy to tell more, and there will soon be publications about the project available, and you can have already a look in Finnish at Kasvatus and Aika. We have there the Finnish journal. If you can read Finnish, we have a couple of early papers there in that journal, but also the in the Journal of the Learning Sciences, the methodological paper will be published in just a few weeks. Thank you so much.